from what he told me, I figured it was going to be a Klan rally or something, you know? A few guys in robes, burning a cross and scaring some people. I had no idea. No idea.
John LaGrasse joined the Leon County Sheriff's Department, based in Tallahassee, Florida, in 2007. Just a few months later, he stumbled on a horrifyingly gruesome event in the swamps along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. His quest to figure out exactly what happened and who was responsible would bring him into contact with my uncle, the linguistic anthropology professor George Gamel Angel. Within less than a year of these events, Deputy LaGrasse's experience would lead him to leave law enforcement for good.
Before I became a deputy, I was a Navy corpsman. I was in Fallujah in 04. So, I mean, I've seen some stuff. But what I saw out there in that swamp, that was by far the worst I've ever seen. I've never experienced anything like that.
From Folk Process, we are Keeping the Bones, the podcast that reimagines and remixes classic weird tales and horror fiction into stories set today. I am your host, Jesse Keller, and today we are bringing you the second episode in our three-part series inspired by H.P. Lovecraft's The Call of Cthulhu. If you haven't heard part one, I highly recommend pausing this and listening to it to catch up. In fact, all of season one is designed to reward re-listening. We've threaded some themes and some elements. We've got some Easter eggs and some tie-ins throughout all the episodes. I recommend going back and just listening to it all the way through. All right, now on with this story. We're continuing with The Call of Cthulhu, Part 2, The Tale of Inspector LaGrasse. In my uncle's notes, alongside his recordings of Khadijah Wilcox and her bizarre dreams from the winter of 2020 and 2021, there's a long document where he recounts a trip to the annual meeting of the American Archaeological Society in St. Louis in January of 2008. He was there to present a paper, but after his talk, he was approached by a man who identified himself as a Leon County, Florida sheriff's deputy. John LaGrasse had come to the conference with a small stone statue, which he said he had found in a Gulf Coast swamp after disrupting what he called a terrible and potentially cult-like gathering.
So, I guess, tell me how did you find out about that conference, about the AIA conference?
I don't remember, but somehow I got this program to start thumbing through, and I saw Professor Angel was giving a talk about decoding ancient languages or something like that. And I thought about those letters things on the statue. And I'm like, well, I'll start with him, I guess. And because I really wasn't coming up with much else, and I was already getting pressure from above to just wrap up the investigation.
Yeah. And so you went up to him. What did you ask him?
Well, I showed him the statue and asked more or less, do you know what the heck this is or what it says?
And what did he say to that?
He said it didn't look like any writing he was familiar with, but he called over some of the other archaeologists and other people at the conference, and pretty soon there was this big group gathered around just looking at it.
Everyone seemed really interested in it.
Yeah, it was it was funny. It was like, because there was all these like guys that really understand language, and they're looking at it and they're scratching their head and they're, you know, throwing out theories and theorems, but you know, nobody really kind of knew what it was.
The other archaeologists and anthropologists, some of the most prominent in their field at the time, seemed to agree that the statuette LaGrasse had brought appeared to be very old and was likely a religious idol of some kind. But that's about all they could agree on. The figure, my uncle writes, had a vaguely anthropoid outline, but with an octopus-like head,
whose face was a mass of feelers, a scaly, rubbery-looking body, prodigious claws on hind and fore feet, and long, narrow wings behind. The figure, he writes, squatted on a rectangular block or pedestal covered with undecipherable characters. The tips of the wings touched the back edge of the block. The seat occupied the center, whilst the long, curved claws of the doubled-up, crouching hind legs gripped the front edge and extended a quarter of the way down toward the bottom of the pedestal. The cephalopod head was bent forward so that the ends of the facial feelers brushed the backs of huge forepaws, which clasped the croucher's elevated knees. The archaeologists could not even agree on what material the idol was carved from or how. My uncle describes it as soapy greenish-black stone with golden or iridescent flecks and striations. There was one person who said the figure looked somewhat familiar. The renowned Princeton anthropologist, Dr. William Channing Webb, known for his work on the Channel Islands in Great Britain. Webb said that the figure vaguely resembled one he had seen on the island of Guernsey as a graduate researcher in the 1950s. There, a similar statue had been the property of a member of the local nobility, a baronet who claimed to trace both his ancestry and ownership of the statue back to the Norman conquest, and before that, via Rollo and the Vikings who first settled Normandy, to the distant past. Professor Webb said that every few years, at regular intervals, the figure was placed on top of a menhir, a standing stone. Representatives of the island's oldest noble families would gather around it, and though Professor Webb was not permitted to observe the entire ritual, he heard the participants chant a phrase that was neither English nor Guernsey French, nor any other language Professor Webb knew. He had transcribed the sounds in the International Phonetic Alphabet, which my uncle copied down in his notes. Here's my best approximation of what it says. Louis Maglornaf Cthulhu Rilye Wagat Nagelftagen.
When he said it, I was like, whoa. That chant that he heard in Britain sounded a whole lot like what I heard the people chanting.
Out there in the swamp, that's the sounds they were making.
Yeah, there were people chanting, and those weird words were exactly how it sounded. They were standing around this tall stone, and that little statue was on top. And then there was a circle of fire around the stone, and then a circle of people around that, and then around them was a circle of wooden scaffolding, and yeah.
Okay, how many people would you say were there?
Probably 30 living ones.
How many not living people?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say, given the state of the remains. I'm not sure we ever did get a definitive answer on the number of deceased.
In the summer of 2007, Deputy John LaGrasse was on the night shift, driving his patrol car down a country road that skirted the swampy wetlands southwest of Tallahassee, Florida.
So I'm driving down the road, and I actually remember some of the other guys have been telling me that in this area, there were these local legends about this creature that lived out there in the swamp, you know, like a Florida Loch Ness monster. And it was supposed to be this pale, blobby thing with glowing eyes, and it always had a bunch of things with bat wings that would fly around.
Bat wings.
Yeah, usually the older guys messing with the rookie, you know. So But driving around there in the middle of nowhere and it's dark, hey, so that's kind of the frame of mind I'm in. Then in my headlights, I see something run out of the bushes and into the road up ahead. And of course, my thoughts is first, oh, is that blobby thing with the bat wing thing? Or, hey, you know, and I stop my car and I'm like, okay, come on, calm down, Johnny, calm down. All right, it's not a monster. That's not real. It's probably an animal, like a deer or something. So I put the spotlight on and it's a man in torn up, raggedy clothes covered in dirt. And he looked like shell-shocked, you know, kind of out of it. Then I noticed he was handcuffed. So my first thought is the guy escaped from law enforcement somewhere, right?
LaGrasse managed to get the man into the back of his patrol car. He was covered in swamp muck and scrapes and bruises.
So I just calmly talking to him. He's not responding. I'm like, do you speak English? What's your name? Can I take you somewhere safe, family, you know? And that's when he says, we need to go save them. Save the others.
The man was Hassan Bolani. Like LaGrasse, he was new to Florida. Bolani was a refugee from Iraq and had recently been resettled in Jacksonville. He now lives in California, which is where I caught up with him. Hassan told me the story of how he ended up on that country road in 2007.
I was completely new to America back then. I'd been here just a few weeks, no more than that. Maybe 1 month. I knew nobody, no family, just people in my job, you know? Some people at the mosque, maybe, you know, maybe I talk with them a little times, maybe we get tea or something like that. One day, I was going home from work. Some people in black suits, they stopped me. He shows badge, and he's like, okay, I have some questions. He asked me things about the mosque. He asked me, can I come with them? I say, yes, of course. I have nothing to hide, you know? So they take me to a black SUV. We drove for a long time. And I was like, excuse me, sir, where are we going? How long will this be? They did not say anything. They took me out of the city and to this place like a farm. They put me in a room, all concrete. You know, very, very dirty, very dirty. I would never leave a room like this. And I was like, please, my friend, Yani, Effendi, what can I tell you? I want to cooperate, yes? They say nothing. I say, can I at least call my boss? I have work tomorrow. But they never spoke to me again. Just left me there.
How long would you say you were there?
Maybe 5-6 days.
Wow. 5 days? So did you have food or water or, I mean, like a place to use the bathroom?
They gave me water and a sandwich, you know, pork meat. So I threw it away and I just ate the bread.
Oh my God.
For toilets, you know, they gave me a bucket, you know, bad, very, very bad. You know, even in Iraq, we didn't have anything as bad. Finally, the men returned.
The men in black suits handcuffed Hassan, put a hood over his head, and drove him to another location, hours away. He was starting to worry he had been mixed up with someone else.
Yani, I was fucking scared. I kept trying to explain. I showed them my documentation, but they would not speak to me. They take me out of the car, you know, after a really, really long drive. And it was hot. It felt sticky. I could hear the insects and the lift-off frogs. It smelled like rot, like things going bad. And I can hear other people. And then something happens. I don't know what. You know, someone screaming and speaking in Arabic. And then the other people in English are like, stop him. And the ones holding me let go for a second. So I, you know, this is my chance. I run. I cannot see. I just run. And then I fall into some water. Like, and there are bushes scraping me. And I hear the men. Like, do you see him? Where is he? So I stay there. I stay there. I sit. Slowly, I get my hands in front and get the hood off. You know, they had a hood bag. I don't know what it is. I take it off so I can see.
Okay, and what did you see?
I was inside, you know, these plants, this long grass that looked like it had hot dogs at the top.
The cattail kind of like reeds.
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, the water is up here, you know, up to my my chest. My feet is, you know, my feet, they stick. They stick. They're stuck beneath the water. I can't move. And I still hear the men. They're looking for me. They're saying, where is he? Where is he? Find him. So I moved away very slowly. I go almost underwater. You know, I leave a little bit up top. And I go slowly, slowly underneath the water. Yani, thank God they did not see me. But I could see them. I could see them. And behind them, on the land, there were other people. It was like a dry island, or, you know, land, but long and thin.
Like a peninsula, like a long...
thin piece of land,
okay,
yes.
Yeah.
You know, and there was this gross water all around. And some open water on the other side. You know, it was like... you know, like the sea. And, you know, there were lots of boats. You know, expensive boats. You know, nothing you'd ever see, you know, in my lifetime. I would never see this. I'd never be on one of them.
So how many people would you say were there all together?
Maybe 20, you know? And they were wearing robe. Long and black. You know, very, very black. And some of them, you know, they were grabbing people. And these people had the chains on their hands. And like me, they had bags on their heads. And there were more of them chained, sitting on the ground. And some men, you know, guns, like soldiers' guns. And around everyone was this big wood, made of wood. It's like a
frame, maybe.
Frame, yes, frame. And while I was looking, you know, another truck comes. They have another person, you know, wearing the chains. I just had to get out of there. I said the prayer, and I kept going. Away and away and away till I could get away.
And how long did you go for until you got to the road?
Yani, a few hours, you know. And then I see, Yani, I thank God. I thank God I find him.
LaGrasse, when I spoke with him, he said that the first thing you said was asking him to go back there. Now, why did you do that?
I could not leave the rest of them. What I escaped, I knew I could not leave the rest of them to that. And they had many people. It was more than just me. How could I leave them? How could I leave them?
So yeah, at first I thought he had maybe escaped from custody, maybe an agency I didn't know was operating down there, DHS, ICE, you know. But then he wanted to go back, and he was talking about people in robes, you know. The FBI and the CIA, they don't wear robes, right? So I decided to check it out. He guided me down some dirt roads for a while, deeper into the swamp. And I was starting to think maybe he was having an episode, you know, like a schizophrenic episode or something. Hmm.
But then he told me that he spotted a fire. He said, over there through the trees, there's a fire.
Sure enough, there was this kind of orange glow, maybe a half mile away through the trees. There's this little track with a sign, private road. Another one that said, trespassers will be shot, survivors will be shot again. That's a popular sign out there. You know, a lot of people, they seem to get a real kick out of that sign.
Yeah, and did you get a kick out of it? What did you think of it at that moment?
I thought it was, I better call for backup and better watch my butt, you know. And I rolled up with my lights off and parked a ways back. I could see the glow of the fire, and when I got out, I could hear this high-pitched wailing sound, almost like an animal noise, but then it would come down and sort of turn into that chant.
The chant, yeah, so the one that you mentioned about at the archaeological meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
That same chant.
Those weird words or sounds.
Right, yeah. Hang on, I've got it. I wrote it down. Let's see. This is what I wrote. Fnglui Maglodnath Cthulhu Rulye Waga Nagel Fatagan.
Yeah, that's it. I still kind of get the shivers hearing that.
At the time you went towards it.
Right. I left Mr. Bellani in the car and I walked down the drive in the dark. Passed a bunch of trucks, SUVs, brand new, like nice vehicles, big lifted F-250s, that kind of thing. I was going through the cypress trees and I could hear the voices and see the flickering of the light from the fire. And I got to a spot where I could see this big open area, like an island in the middle of the swamp. There were 30 or 40 people in black robes all circled around a ring-shaped fire. And in the middle of that ring was a tall stone, kind of a monolith. And on top was a little statue of that creature. And surrounding all of that was a ring of scaffolds.
Scaffolds. So, yeah, tell me about those.
Yeah.
If you can.
These scaffolds made of wood, like big frames. And they had people hanging upside down on them, hanging from their legs, and parts of people, body parts, strung up all in this huge frame. And some of the people, the more complete ones, were still moving and screaming, moaning. Yeah.
Deputy LaGrasse ran back to his car and called for as much backup as he could get as fast as they could send it.
Mr. Bellani was asking me, how are the others? Are they okay? And I'm just like, I don't know, maybe.
Not long after, more police, they show. They have the trucks, they have the guns. And everyone's just running around the car and, yelling. And I was in the back. I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to understand. And I can hear shooting. I can hear the guns. I can hear them going. And I hear the yelling. And the police, they were bringing the people. They were bringing, the ones in the robes. And I recognized the two that first, they brought me. The two that brought me. And I yelled. I yelled and tried to say something. But they did not hear me, I was in the back of the car. Maybe they did not hear me, the glass. And then they bring out people covered in blood. The beds that they hold, the people they
like
come in.
Like a gurney, like an ambulance, yes. Stretcher, yeah.
Covered in blood.
Oh my God.
St. Simon County deputies responded to the call and...
St. Simon County? I thought you said Leon County Sheriff.
Oh yeah. I crossed county lines apparently. So me and half a dozen deputies roll in and we're yelling at people to get on the ground and it's like they were oblivious. Like they didn't even know we were there. They just kept on chanting until we physically took them down. Then some of them sort of snapped out of it and ran for their trucks to get away or out to the boats that were anchored out in the estuary. Some shots were fired. It was pretty chaotic. And we finally got it all under control, though. I think some of the boats actually got away.
So I know this is a tough subject, but can you tell me about those bodies that were on the scaffold and what that was like?
Yeah. There were at least three that were still alive, hanging upside down on the scaffold, and the EMTs took them. One was a refugee like Mr. Bellani, and the others, I believe, were homeless individuals. And then just so many bodies, body parts, so many.
Through a Freedom of Information Act request, I managed to get a hold of that official report describing the incident. It was heavily redacted, but it generally confirms John's account, though the unredacted portion
doesn't mention what he called cult-like activities, chanting, or the stone idol. It simply describes a quote-unquote gathering, which was quote-unquote interrupted. 36 people were taken into custody. 3 living victims, who were not named, were transported to local hospitals. And there was a, quote, large amount of partial human remains belonging to an unknown number of individuals, end quote. The report says that some of those remains were, at the time of the arrest, quote, in the possession of, unquote, the arrestees. The unredacted portion doesn't go any further into detail. But it does quote a deputy Antonio Galvez saying that he heard a low beating sound, like wings, and saw a large white shape moving among the cypress trees in the swamp.
I don't remember that. I do remember Galvez, and he was really losing it. Several people were. We were taking people into custody, and a lot of them seemed completely zoned out. I thought they must have been on something, like hallucinogens or something, but the toxicology came back all negative. Then I was sort of taken aback because I was seeing some faces I recognized.
People, you recognize some of the people that were at this meeting?
Yeah. I have to sort of be careful here because how it all went, you know?
Right.
But there were at least 2 guys I knew from my department. They were county sheriffs, like higher-ups, who I believe are still employed there, in fact. There were others, politicians from Tallahassee, people from the business community. One guy had a large amount of blood on him. I recognized him as a federal agent who had come to lead a workshop on counterterrorism. These people, at least some of them, were fairly prominent. And here they were in robes doing a chant, and they had these bodies and body parts in a sort of trance.
Wow.
And once everyone is hauled off, the investigation starts. And they're like, we're good here. You can head out. So I headed out, dropped Mr. Bellani off at his residence, and headed home. So it was the next day when I got to work, and I asked about the investigation. And it felt very strange. People at the Leon County Sheriff's barely knew about it. Nobody seemed that interested. They said it wasn't our jurisdiction, and that there were just 4 people taken in.
Just 4 people out of...
Yeah, and I'm like, 4 people? There were 40 people that we took in. I called St. Simon County, and the investigator seemed real cagey, like, well, there's not that much evidence, you know, et cetera, and these people are not flight risk, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, huh? Okay, all right. And it felt like they were, like, sweeping this whole thing under the rug. There was a lot of pressure from a lot of people, and it seemed like the evangelist lady was just going to take the fall for everyone. And they'd all get off scot-free. And I started to worry about Mr. Bellani's safety.
You know, with God as my witness, I was just happy to be alive.
Yeah, I believe that, yes.
You know, I went back to my life. I went back to work. My boss, you know, LeGrasse, he talked to him, told him I was helping the police. You know, that was enough for him. A couple of weeks later, you know, maybe 2-3 later, LeGrasse, he calls me and says, you may not be safe. He was very serious, and he was the only one who helped me, that I really needed help.
And so, what did he tell you? What did he...
He says to me, it's not safe, you need to go. You need to go. So, I listened to him. Seriously, I decided, you know, I will listen to him. He is serious, I will be serious, I move.
Just based on his word alone, you decided to move.
He was the only one who helped me. I trust him.
After that, I guess I kind of took it on myself to keep investigating. I couldn't leave it alone.
After he had participated in breaking up the unimaginably grisly cult-like gathering in the marshlands along Florida's Gulf Coast in 2007, Deputy John LaGrasse was surprised and frustrated by the small number of arrests and prosecutions.
Majority of them that were taken into custody never even got booked. The only ones who actually did any time over anything that happened there were a few people were charged with misdemeanor improper storage of human remains.
Wow.
Can you believe that? I mean, come on. That's a heck of an understatement. Improper storage? And then there was that evangelist lady, Miss Hedges, who seemed to kind of be the ringleader. And I believe she did some prison time. I don't know, really. By the time she was sentenced, I was gone.
Gina Hedges, along with her husband Frank, founded the non-denominational evangelical organization Arise and Awaken Christian Ministries, where they both preached in the 1980s, 90s, and early 2000s. At the time of Gina's arrest, their congregation numbered in the thousands. When officers arrived at the scene of the cult meeting, Hedges was next to one of the bodies on the scaffold with a knife in her hand. Despite this, in her initial interrogation, the night of the arrest, Hedges denied that she had killed anyone.
He was already dead.
Okay, so what were you doing there with the knife, Gina?
I just needed a piece. Just a little. But I did not kill anyone.
Who killed them then?
The Blackwings did the killing. They come out of the swamp.
Uh-huh. Blackwings.
You with no faces? They did the killing. We just took what we needed. The pieces. That was our role.
And what did you need the pieces for?
Different things. Different parts of the offering.
The offering. Offering to...
the great old ones.
Investigators interrogated a number of people that had been arrested that night, though they only charged Hedges and three others with crimes. Everyone that they spoke to still seemed spaced out in a daze, like John had described. But when they were interviewed, their responses were remarkably consistent.
So these great old ones, they came, these cosmic beings, they're dead, they're buried.
Why do you worship them if they're dead?
They can only live when the stars are right. Then they live and have even greater power. They're dead, but they're dreaming. They dream to us. That's how we know about them.
What do they look like? Like a this statue?
That is Great Cthulhu. He was their priest. They came from beyond the stars and brought their idols with them. They built great cities and lived and died long before the creation of mankind. Long before.
Gina, you're a person of faith, right? You're a Christian.
I am.
I am too, Gina. I am too. I've seen you preach even, at Arise. And I gotta say, this sounds not very
Hold
Christian.
Hold on now. I am Christian, sir. I have been saved by Christ. I know the power of the Lord our God, but the Lord is our God, the God of mankind. You remember Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, right? Genesis says, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth, and darkness was on the face of the deep." Now, it does not say God created the face of the deep or darkness, you see? They were already there. The Lord, our God, had to come along and divide the light from the darkness. Before, it was all one thing. And God divided a bit off of it here, a bit there, divide off the light, divide up the waters. But the darkness is still there, just not on the face of the deep. See? It is with the great old ones, dead and dreaming down under the deep. They have great power, and we tap into that, an old and very mighty power. And there is a way, when the stars are right, there's ways of helping bring about their return. And those that call them when the stars are right will sit at their right hand in power.
I thought they were dead.
Funglui, Glontnoth, Cthulhu, Relie, Waga, Noggle, Fatagan.
What is that? What does that mean?
In his house, at Relie, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming. That's how they talk to us. How we know what to do. They dream to us. They dream us the methods of their return. People have known it for years, centuries, heck, forever. As long as we've dreamed and dreamed of power, we've known it. Back in the Middle Ages, Alhazred wrote, "That is not dead which can eternal lie. And with strange eons, even death may die."
Because of all the evidence, the knife was literally in her hand. Gina Hedges eventually pled guilty to a charge of voluntary manslaughter and served 3 years in prison. She was released in 2007 and returned to the ministry, where she stayed until her death. In 2020, Gina Hedges passed away at her home in Atlanta at the age of 65. The other three pled guilty to misdemeanor improper handling of human remains and were sentenced to time served. Nobody else was ever charged, and the case seems never to have been reported in the media.
After that, it just faded away. But I couldn't let it go after what I saw. When I found out about the archaeology conference, I went down to St. Simon and checked out the statue out of the evidence room. I said I needed it for an investigation. And that's why they fired me. Mishandling of evidence without proper authorization. Evidence in a case that was basically being ignored. So I moved away and got on with my life, you know. What else could I do?
When the sculptor Khadijah Wilcox showed up at Professor Angel's office in December of 2020, my uncle writes in his notes that she didn't know what happened in Florida in 2007. My uncle didn't immediately notice the similarity between the still wet clay relief she showed him and the small idol carved from unidentifiable green stone that Deputy John LaGrasse had brought to the conference a decade and a half before. It wasn't until Khadijah described her dream of the vast city covered in muck and the omnipresent voice, the dream during which she claimed to have sculpted the relief, that, as he writes, he was thunderstruck, bowled over by the realization. The figures depicted were one and the same. Though the artistic styles were completely different, he writes, "The winged octopus-headed creature and perhaps even the strange characters were nearly identical in shape." He jotted down a string of key words: dreams, sea cult, beneath the face of the deep, Cthulhu Ftagen. When I started working on this story, I thought I was mainly going to be investigating a violent secret society John LaGrasse had discovered and whose existence had been covered up 15 years ago. My uncle, Professor Angel's observation that the cult's bizarre beliefs and monstrous stone idol bore some similarity to dreams, artwork, and wild conspiracy theories of 2020 gave the story a uniquely weird and macabre flair, even if they did seem kind of far-fetched. Then I found something else in his notes, something I almost missed. And when I followed up on it, everything seemed less far-fetched and more disturbing than I could have imagined. It made me almost certain that my uncle's sudden death on that boat dock in San Diego was not from natural causes. I'm not going to lie, it also made me think I'd stumbled onto a great story. You can judge for yourself whether that part's true. But I'm starting to wish I'd never found it in the first place. Next time on Keeping the Bones, I'll tell you what I found. When we bring you the last episode of this series and of our first season, The Call of Cthulhu Part 3, Madness from the Sea. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Bones. This penultimate episode of Keeping the Bones was inspired by part 2 of H.P. Lovecraft's classic story, The Call of Cthulhu, the tale of Inspector LaGrasse. The voices you heard today were Ron Christopher Jones, Osama Mezguri, Deborah Branham, and Carr Cavender. Like I said, if you dug this show and want to hear more, please do rate, subscribe, follow, all of that. And if you can, kick in a few bucks at patreon.com/keepingthebones to keep this operation running. We'll be back soon with the final episode of season 1.